Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of January. In the January-February issue of The Atlantic, Election 2016 is the cover story. Two great articles, The Great Republican Revolt, written by David Frum, and Why America is Moving Left by Peter Beinart. Both gentlemen are with us during this hour and half-hour segments. We are collaborating with NPR all year, and particularly today, to explore the political mood of the country, the impact fear and anxiety might have on the election, and this hour a special emphasis on economic uncertainty. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. Are you uncertain? Are you fearful? Do you have anxiety as you go into the polling place this fall? And if so, how will that influence who you intend to vote for? We are welcoming calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also welcoming your comments on Twitter, and you can reach us on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Two guests with us. David Frum is with us. David was a speechwriter for George W. Bush. He is senior editor at The Atlantic and chair of the Policy Exchange, and we're delighted to have you with us. Hello, David.
Thank you. Hello.
Yeah, really good articles. Here's the crux of the whole thing. You write, in 2014, real median income, household income, remained $4,000 below the pre-recession level, well below 1999. Most people have not recovered from the recession. And you go on to say that party elites could try to open more ideological space for the economic interests of the middle class.
Right. But they didn't. And into that non-opening barged Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. So why didn't they? Everybody, isn't it obvious that that's what's going on in the country? We hear that every day.
Well, ideology is a powerful thing, and self-interest is a powerful thing. And parties are run by circles of very few people. In the Republican Party, especially what happened after the 2012 defeat, which was came as a strange surprise to party elites. I mean, I predicted it. I wrote a book called Why Romney Lost that I published on the Thursday after the vote. Hmm. And while I write fast, I don't write that fast. but most party elites were surprised. So there's a huge postmortem effort after the 2012 defeat. And the conclusion that was come to, and I quote in the Atlantic article, many examples of important people saying this, was that there was nothing wrong with the core message of the party. The one mistake the party had made was a concession it had never liked anyway, and that was Mitt Romney's tentative interest in toughening immigration a little bit. Party elites had never liked that policy, and that was the thing on which they pinned all the blame. Everything else, the proposal to withdraw Medicare guarantees from people under age 55, Social Security privatization, tightening entitlements, all the other things the party had campaigned on, no problem with that. And so the party locked in, and people in these echo chambers talk themselves into it. The donors believe it. Mm-hmm. And the thing about donors is they're rich people. Mm-hmm. And as I remark in the Atlantic article, one of the more dangerous pleasures of great wealth is that no one will ever tell you you're wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read that and I thought, oh my goodness. And there are a lot of those people making a lot of decisions. You also, let's look at the mass of Republican voters who care, you write, more about aligning government with their values of work and family than they care about cutting the size of government as an end in itself. What are those values of work and family that are so important?
A team of Harvard sociologists went and talked to a lot of people who attended Tea Party rallies in 2010, 2009. And remember, the Tea Party was always described as a movement against government spending, against the debt, as if it were demanding the full implementation of the economic policy of the Wall Street Journal editorial page. But when you actually talk to Tea Party people, and I talked to a few as a journalist, but this team talked to dozens, what they talked about was their sense that there was a difference between programs that people had paid into through work, especially Medicare, and programs that you got because you weren't working. and they drew a sharp moral distinction between the first and the second category. And they thought the first were justifiable and right and due, and it was the second they had trouble with. But the problem is the second group, the programs that support people, the income support programs, are not that expensive, whereas the really costly programs are those that people contribute to. So when Republican budget cutters look at, well, how are we going to reduce the cost of government so we can finance some big tax cuts, they don't look at the women, you know, that nutrition programs for pregnant women, they're just not that big. What is big is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Is the Republican Party, the makeup of the party, super conservative now?
No, it's not that super conservative. Or there are people in it who are very conservative. At least they say they are. If you ask them, they will tell you they are very conservative. But when you actually probe it, it's not clear that it is indeed so very ideological. And certainly Trump's voters or supporters, no one's voted yet, his supporters are people who are less ideologically conservative. They are people who are less religious, less affluent, and less educated.
Mm-hmm. And yet the guy who's in number two spot who might win Iowa, Ted Cruz, is extremely conservative.
And his supporters, one of the best ways of predicting who's going to vote for Trump and who's going to vote for Cruz is you say, are you an evangelical? And Trump does well. Both of those men do well with evangelicals. But if you say, do you go to church every week? Or have you been to college? That those who go to church regularly and who have attended college are much more likely to attend Cruz. Because one of the things that has happened in America over the past decade and a half is that just as marriage, which used to be something that everybody did, has become closely connected with more affluence and more education, that's now true for church attendance. So there are a lot of people who say they're evangelicals, but they're not super affiliated to any institution, and the people who are super affiliated tend to be more educated and more affluent.
Mm-hmm. What about those cultural issues that Republicans have played in previous elections? Same-sex marriage was big this year. Issues like immigration, the country becoming more of a minority population than a Caucasian population. Are those big issues for Republican voters?
Immigration, yes. Same-sex marriage, no. And this is an example also, by the way, of how the Republican Party has been seduced by its own ideology. You'll remember that back in 2004, there were a number of ballot initiatives on same-sex marriage. And both anti-Republican critics and many Republicans themselves gave credit to these measures as being the reason that the Republicans won the 2004 election. 2000, of course, is famously close, touch and go. The Republicans did not win the popular vote. In 2004, they did. And that election was decided by a very few thousand votes in Ohio. And there are a lot of claims that it was a same-sex marriage initiative that explained it. But when you looked at all 50 states and looked at the states in which the Republican vote had gone up the most, you saw those were states in which same-sex marriage was not on the ballot. And if you looked at the states in which the Republican vote had gone up the least, the same-sex marriage was on the ballot. And I'm now going to forget where Ohio was in the bottom 10 by the degree to which the Republican vote increased. It was not a big mobilizer even in 2004, and much less now. I think you have to draw a distinction between those social issues that have to do with people's personal, familial, and sexual lives and those that have to do with national identity. Mm-hmm. The first group aren't that powerful, but it's the second group that are. Mm-hmm. Immigration is a hugely important issue this year.
So let's go back to where we started. Most people have not recovered from the recession. What is it that any of the Republican candidates could do now, or what the party needs to do as a whole, David, to address that very important issue?
Well, the candidates aren't doing it, but the party should. For sure, immigration restriction has to be part of the program, but it can't be the whole of it. Republicans have to be more mindful that there are a lot more people who are going to need Medicare and who are going to need Social Security. It's going to loom larger in the retirement plans of the baby boomers and the post-baby boomers than people imagined back in 1998 when the trajectory of the country looked better than it did today, than it does today. We are going to have to worry less about cutting taxes at the very top. We are going to have to worry more about making sure that government continues to invest in hard infrastructure supports Republican voters. Let me draw a distinction here. The Obama stimulus of 2009-2010 spent relatively little money on roads, bridges, airports. That's how it was sold, but that's not where the money went. The money went to what you might call soft infrastructure. It went to sustaining state school systems and health systems. Those have the effect of employing a lot of people who tend to vote Democratic and relatively few of the kind of hard hat workers who tend to vote Republican. Mm-hmm. Water treatment plants, airports, bridges, tunnels, hard infrastructure, that tends to have an impact on Republican-type voters. And Republicans, just as Democrats look out for their voters, Republicans should be looking out for their own voters.
What about the Affordable Care Act? Certainly we've heard many Republicans say, first day in office, I'm going to repeal that. You in the piece say that Republicans need to make peace with universal health insurance coverage.
I've been banging this drum for a long time. And in fact, I got fired from the conservative think tank where I was working in 2010 for...
Did you really?
You can look it up. But I wrote an article on the I'd been urging through 2009 that Republicans needed to work with President Obama, not because I like the Affordable Care Act so much, but because he was willing to do some things that were promising and difficult for a Democrat to do. Plus, he had put into the Affordable Care Act a lot of things that were only there to annoy Republicans, and they were there to get Republicans to the table. It's a classic negotiating technique. You come up with a plan, and you put something in it the other guy is, you know, he's going to hate. And that way you say, okay, I'll take it out, but here's what I need from you. But Republicans refused to negotiate because they believed they could win. And just as they had in 94. And I argued, you're not going to win. Democrats have seen this movie too. They are going to stick together in a way they did not in 1994. On the day the Affordable Care Act passed in March of 2010, I wrote a blog post that said, you should have done business, because it will now take us 20 years of blood, toil, sweat, and tears to get these annoying things out of the Affordable Care Act that we could have had for the asking in 2009 and 2010. And 4 days later, I was an ex-think tank employee.
Ooh. David Frum is our guest, the first
I can't entirely blame them, but there we are.
Yeah, you bounced back. you did okay. Our phone number, we'd like to hear from you. We're talking this hour about the political mood of the country. David Frum is one of the articles in the January-February issue of The Atlantic. A very interesting piece, and we're coupling that with another piece by Peter Beinart. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. David has written, he was a former speechwriter for George W. Bush, about the Great Republican Revolt, and Peter has written about why America is becoming more left. I guess the question to you is, most Americans have not recovered from the recession. We're looking at economic fears and anxiety right now. I'm sure that many of you are in that classification. If so, how does that affect your vote in the presidential election? Maybe you haven't decided yet who you're voting for, but who do you think speaks to that particular issue? It's a major one in this election. We've talked about it, heavens knows, many, many programs over the past few years. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. So please give us your messages. We're doing this in conjunction, sort of a day-long effort with National Public Radio, so all of what you say will be forwarded there so they can get a sense of where the country is nationally. They're doing this with other stations all over the country. All right, let's go to your phone calls, and we start with Tim in Chicago. Hi, Tim.
Hi. One of the questions is, what does the speaker think about the electoral process, I shouldn't say the process, but the voters, in terms of what has happened when we have these two extreme kind of leaders, whether it's Ted Cruz and Donald Trump or kind of Bernie Sanders on the other side, what does that say about the general public?
Okay, good question.
Well, I don't think the general public has become hyper-ideological, but I do think it is hyper-anxious. And I think the parties, this is not just my observation, we have seen the parties becoming more extreme and polarized. And there's a lot of history in political science about why that should be so. It has to do, I think, with changes in the way that the parties are organized. They used to be real membership organizations. I'm talking now 50, 60 years ago. Fraternal lodges that used to be so important in American life. They're full of people who are there for all kinds of reasons, for companionship, because they were Catholic, because their great-grandfather had fought for the Union, to to meet somebody to get married to. People and now they are much more committed and ideological, and they pull into them people who are in politics for ideas, which sounds great, but it was all the people who were not interested in the ideas who kept the parties rooted in the center.
Let me ask you to respond just briefly, because we're having Peter on, and I'll ask him to respond to what you had to write, Peter Beinart's column in the same issue of The Atlantic, that America really is moving left. Do you think it is?
Well, Peter is my colleague and my friend, so I'm kind of awkward saying I don't think he's correct, but I don't think he's correct.
Mm-hmm.
He's correct in a specialized sense. When you look at the attitudes of white voters under 30, Peter talks in the article about millennials, but when you look at white voters under 30, they look a lot like white voters over 50. They are generally skeptical about the role of government. They are generally skeptical about the role of taxes. They want to see less economic redistribution. It's just that among the under 30s, white voters are a smaller share of the electorate than they are among over 50. So it's not an ideological change we are seeing. It's a demographic change, that the conservative voters are being increasingly outnumbered, and that's because of immigration, that the United States has imported a huge new population, which has very different ideas about the role of government and very different needs and claims, because the immigrants this is not true of all people, obviously, but it's true in the average. Immigrants to the United States since 1980 have been much poorer and less economically mobile than the native-born, much poorer and less economically mobile than immigrants who arrived before 1980. They need more help. They believe in help, and they are changing the way the political system operates. And the Trump phenomenon is in part a reaction to that, to newcomers voting one way, which drives old stock inhabitants to vote in a different way.
And yet the Republican Party, tell me if you think I'm right here, needs to pay attention to those voters because their percentage is increasing fairly dramatically. And one could say that Mitt Romney lost the last election because he didn't have nearly the minority vote, particularly the Latino vote, that George Bush had.
One could say that, but I don't know how. I mean, that's obviously arithmetically true, but I'm not sure it's politically true. That this is where you get into the line of thinking that the Republicans pursued so disastrously after 2013. That the reason Republicans have problems with Latino voters was not because of immigration, or that was the least of it. When you Latino voters are very unlikely to have health insurance. They need a health insurance answer. They earn much lower incomes in the average. We're not talking about everybody, but you know, add everybody up, divide by the number of head, you get the medians and the means, and you see they're a poorer population. They're much more heavily dependent on government income support programs. So if the Republican Party is going to make inroads, it's going to need a lot of changes. There is no magic key that says, okay, well, we'll offer them the Ryan plan plus immigration reform and they'll come and vote for us. That's really not true. And that was the mistake the party made in its evaluations in 2013.
David Frum is our guest for about five more minutes, senior editor at The Atlantic, chair of the Policy Exchange, and was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. We're talking about two articles appearing in The Atlantic, the January-February issue. David wrote one of them, and trying to get a feel for the political mood of the country on this January 26, this election year. Do you have fear and anxiety, particularly about the economy or about other issues? Do you find that there's a candidate who's responding in a significant way that makes you more likely to support him or her in this 2016 presidential race? We welcome your phone calls, and we have time for a few more for David. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. David's article in The Atlantic is titled "The Great Republican Revolt." This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, David Frum, let's go through as many phone calls as we can right now and start with Ryan in Platteville. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Dred. So my question for your guest is why anyone in the white working class should vote for any politician across the political spectrum who isn't against immigration. If you look at the industries across this country that were typically blue-collar, and you could support a family on that wage, whether it's in the meatpacking or construction industries, If you walk around any job site in Madison with the building boom going on that is not one of the big three union construction firms, I'm pretty sure if your listeners would drive around and look on those sites, and it's, most of those guys are going to be of Hispanic origin. So, just saying.
All right, David?
I'm largely with the caller on this. I do think we need a more restrictionist approach to immigration to protect wages. I agree with that. I don't think that means zero. And I don't think we should assume that the way America does immigration is the only way immigration can be done. I mean, one of my immigration reforms is to say, if you've got a job that offer that pays more than $300,000 a year, you should get a green card. You know, we've seen how CEO pay has spiked in the past 20 years. Obviously, we have a terrible shortage in America of executive talent, or otherwise their pay wouldn't go up so much. Meanwhile, for working class jobs, we've seen the pay go down. So that means we have a surplus of supply. So just supply and demand would tell you what we need are to import more people to do executive jobs and cut their pay, and fewer people competing with jobs in construction and meatpacking and other jobs where wages have gone down. Immigration is not obviously the whole of the answer. A lot of the changes are driven by trade and by technology and by things it's harder to do something about. But certainly we shouldn't be adding to the burdens of the American worker.
And thank you, Ryan, for the call. Earl in Medford is next. Hi, Earl.
Hi. I'm concerned that there could be a war against senior citizens as more and more of us live longer, and then the federal dollars go toward Social Security, Medicare, and keeping those up. And also, very inadequate planning, I'm saying, for homes, transportation, not just these nursing homes or huge places, but places that seniors can live and live happily.
I think you mentioned that in the article. It would be a good thing for Republicans to focus on, David.
That's such an important point. I completely concur with what the caller has said. Look, one of the reasons we're all so anxious is we have had this huge economic slowdown at exactly the moment the baby boomers are arriving in their retirement years and are going to be making big claims on the resources of government. And you're seeing this across the developed world, by the way. This is not just an American phenomenon. But people over 65, you know, they cease working. They get sick more often. They need medical care. They need other forms of attention, too. The caller is very right about transportation issues as a looming area of concern. And again, technology can help us out there. But there's a lot more demand on the resources of government. There's a lot more competition. The immigration issue makes it more complicated because people don't necessarily feel as much national kinship with the people they are competing against. And all of these problems get harder to solve, and voters look at each other more suspiciously than they did 10, 20, 30 years ago.
One more phone call for you. It's Gail in New London. Hi, Gail.
Hi there. I was wondering what your guest thinks the long-term effect will be on Sarah Palin's endorsement of Donald Trump.
It doesn't need to have a long-term effect. It needs to have an effect that lasts for the next 4 or 5 days. If Donald Trump wins the Iowa caucuses, and he's far in first place in New Hampshire, he's in a very strong position. And let's remember how few people vote in the Iowa caucuses, especially the Republican caucuses. In 2012, the gap between the first place and the second place finisher in Iowa, if I remember right, was 34 votes.
Ooh,
on the Republican side.
Really?
So if Sarah Palin can tip 500, she doesn't have to tip hundreds of thousands of people. If she can tip 500 or 600 people from undecided to Trump, that's a big event.
Do you think she can, or have people had enough of her?
Donald Trump thinks she can. So obviously he thinks it's worthwhile. Somebody paid for her gas to that event, and I don't think it was Sarah Palin herself.
David, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, hope we can chat again during this presidential year. David Frum, his article is The Great Republican Revolt, which is in the January-February issue of The Atlantic. And we thank him very much. We're just switching guests now with another important essay that is also in The Atlantic. And this one is written by Peter Beinart. Peter's article is Why America is Moving Left, Republicans may have a lock on Congress and the nation's state houses and could well win the presidency, but the liberal era ushered in by Barack Obama is only just beginning. Peter is a contributing editor at The Atlantic and National Journal, associate professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York, and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Peter, hello. Thank you very much for being with us for our discussion today. Hi.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about, because we just had David on the air who wrote speeches for George W. Bush, let's talk about the Democratic Party before George W. Bush, the strong centrist wing of the party. Remind us of that history and then what happened to the Democratic Party following George W. Bush.
I think George W. Bush had a profound effect on the Democratic Party. There have been a whole generation of Democrats called, something called New Democrats, associated with the Democratic Leadership Council, who had grown up, come of age under Ronald Reagan, and they had said, you know what, this is a pretty conservative country. The left has been wrong about some things, and if we're going to compete, we need to adapt to Reagan's America. That means not being the same as the Republicans, but it means being tougher on national security, strong, supporting a bigger military, being more interventionist abroad. It means being willing to deregulate some industries. It means being willing to be a little more culturally conservative, more very tough on crime, for instance, supporting the reform of welfare.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things were things that were very strongly felt among a lot of Democratic Party intellectuals and politicians in Congress in the 1990s, among them Bill Clinton and Al Gore. But what happened was when George W. Bush became president and passed a huge tax cut that Democrats believed had been disastrous for the deficit, deregulated in ways that contributed to the financial crisis, used this hawkishness to invade Afghanistan and Iraq, it produced a kind of revolution in the Democratic Party, a revolt against that centrism of the 1990s, and towards created an entire new ethos, a whole new infrastructure, much more focused on militantly opposing Republicans and kind of and pushing the Democratic Party to the left. And we saw that first with Howard Dean's insurgent campaign, which almost won in 2004, and then with Barack Obama's victory in 2008. And we're seeing the continuation of it, not just with Bernie Sanders, but with the way that Hillary Clinton has had to adapt to Bernie Sanders by moving herself to the left.
Mm. And some of those people who are involved in those campaigns, particularly Bernie Sanders, were also, you remind us in the article, people who were part of the Occupy movement and were rather dissatisfied with Obama's actions on a number of issues.
Right. My argument is that if George W. Bush pushed the Democratic Party to the left, that in a different kind of way, Barack Obama also pushed the Democratic Party to the left. Because what happened was that, you know, Barack Obama was in many ways the liberal president of many Democrats' dreams. But by the second half of his presidency, when people saw, well, wait a second, that Wall Street's power really hasn't been curtailed, that there's still structural racism in our criminal justice system, it produced a new activism represented by Occupy on the economic front and Black Lives Matter on the race front, which basically said, you know what, even with the best liberal president, nothing fundamentally is going to change unless we bring change from the streets. And that has pushed the Democratic Party even further to the left than it was when Obama was elected in 2008.
Do you break this down by generations?
Yes, I think there is a generational element there. I think the center of gravity has moved in general, but in particular I think you see younger people in general are further to the left, but inside the Democratic Party as well. Now that's partly for a variety of reasons. It's partly because younger people, I think, they have grown up in a somewhat rougher economic environment than people who grew up, who came of age in the 1990s when jobs were more plentiful and wages were going up. It's also because, you know, the effects of the Iraq and Afghanistan war and the financial crisis, I think for kind of millennials have shaken some of the basic axiomatic faith in In American power, in the world, in capitalism itself. You see a remarkably high percentage of millennials say they identify with as a socialist rather than with capitalism. A remarkable percentage say they don't necessarily think America is the greatest country in the world, much more likely to be secular. And you could see that these are the people who Bernie Sanders is really appealing. You know, him, despite the fact that he's 74 years old, he is walloping Hillary Clinton among younger voters.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the recession. And there are a lot of millennials. Everybody's been suffering as a result. I think David, in his article, cites some pretty remarkable statistics that we've done tons of shows on, that we have all lost money. The median household income remaining $4,000 below pre-recession level, well below 1999. People have not recovered from the recession. Young people are working two and three jobs to get by. Their incomes are nowhere near what my starting incomes would have been in the 1970s in this country. People are really struggling, and I'm wondering how that is changing who they may vote for in the Democratic field, and Peter, also in the Republican field, and if that makes sense where they're going.
No, I think you're right. And, you know, it's not just that wages have not returned, but that the jobs that people can get are much less likely to have health benefits.
Yes.
Although Obamacare has helped that a bit, that the whole safety net, the whole American safety net, is really structured towards giving benefits to the elderly, not giving benefits to the young. And that as state, you know, as states have begun devoting less and less of their budgets to tuitions, more and more of the budget for even public universities have been falling on students who have to take out tremendous amount of student loans. So there's a whole series of things that I think have made life very difficult economically for people in the, you know, in the decade in which they really need to start to move into the workforce. What's interesting, and then, you know, what's interesting is that you're seeing this anxiety play itself out differently within the two parties. In the Republican Party, those younger people, and especially a lot of older people, because also there were older people who lost their jobs during the Great Recession, were never able to get jobs like that again. There, you're seeing that the antagonism is really being is really focusing to a large degree on immigrants, and we need to have a border again in this country, and mm-hmm. that's really what Trump is tapping into. I think that what you're seeing in the Democratic Party is a different analysis. The argument is that the fundamental problem is at the top, not at the bottom with these low-skill workers, but with Wall Street, and the fact that, as Bernie Sanders says again and again, that such a vast percentage of the growth of the growth in national income is going to the top 1%. So you have economic anxiety and insecurity on both sides, but you have a different explanation for what's behind it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls for you. Peter Beinart with us this half hour of our hour, and he is also at The Atlantic. He's a contributing editor and associate professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. His piece in the current issue is Why America is Moving Left. And our focus this hour is what your fears and anxieties may be, particularly concerning the economy and how that may influence who you're voting for. Is somebody speaking to you? Is somebody speaking to all of those Americans who feel as though they have not recovered from the recession? And you can move us into other areas as well. Would you feel better if we cut back on immigration? Would you feel better if we tax those who are very wealthy? Does anybody speak to those issues? Are there others that are important to you? Let us know. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page of the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we go to Rod in Weyerhaeuser next. Hello, Rod.
Yes, thank you, Kathleen. Another good, interesting program. No, I just would like the man's response, and kind of if he could explain. My neighbor's a Vietnam veteran, and he, anytime we get together and just start discussing this, he tells me that I am looking at the biggest Republican on the face of the earth, and he says he loved John F. Kennedy.
And who does he love now, Rod?
He didn't really care that much for G.W. Bush. I think what it is because he was a Vietnam veteran and John F. Kennedy wanted to pull the troops out. I think that played a big part in it, but mm-hmm. He doesn't think much of Obama, but
yeah. Peter, you want to respond?
Sure. Well, you know, there have been a tremendous political transformations in what the identity is of the two parties since John F. Kennedy. you know, Hillary Clinton grew up in a very Republican family. It's worth remembering.
She was a Goldwater supporter. Yeah.
She was a Goldwater supporter, right. The back in the 1960s, if you think about the Nixon-Kennedy election in 1960, there was not a great ideological difference between the two candidates, really. It was really only later on in the 60s that you saw first the emergence of the culture war issues that we now associate with the two parties. The Democratic Party is the party kind of more secular and tolerant party. The Republican Party is the party of evangelical Christians, of traditional values, on issues like abortion, gay rights, the polarization on race. And then also starting in the 70s and 80s with Reagan, the Republican Party moving in a much more anti-tax, anti-regulation direction. So you see this growing gulf between the two parties, both on its cultural policy, on economic policy, and on foreign policy. John F. Kennedy was very hawkish, in some ways more hawkish than Richard Nixon when they ran against each other in 1960. But again, in recent decades, the Democratic Party has been the party that's been more associated with dovishness. So I think this is part of the reason that people who might have felt comfortable in the Democratic or Republican Party, you know, three or four decades ago, now feel like the party has been changed beyond recognition, because both parties have changed quite in some fundamental ways compared to what they were like in the Kennedy era.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to, thanks, Rod, for your call. Richard in Duluth. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine. How are you, Richard?
I'm doing fine. One thing I'd like to mention is that I'm a 69-year-old truck driver. I retired back when I was 65, only to find that I had to go back to work. But my point being, what I want to make is, I think both writers are ignoring some of the basic things that have happened in this country over the last 60 years. And they're seeing a revolution in the Republican Party, but they're seeing a revolution in the Democratic Party, too. And I'm not just referring to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. I think what you're going to find this time around is a lot of minority, black in particular, are going to be voting Republican. For 50 years, the Democratic policies have failed to accomplish what they set out to do. We spent trillions of dollars in the last 50 years, and we've not solved one problem that we set out to solve.
All right, Richard, thanks for your call. I'm sorry we have a lot of calls coming in. You think more blacks in particular will vote Republican this go around, Peter?
Well, it depends who the Republicans nominate. I mean, there are some people who think that Donald Trump might get a larger percentage of the African-American vote. I mean, the Democrats won't be nominating an African-American candidate, so that may give the Republicans a little more of a chance. But I don't necessarily agree with the premise. I actually think that there have been some government interventions like early childhood education, certainly Social Security and Medicare, which have virtually wiped out with poverty among the elderly, that have had a big impact. And while it's true that people may have not recovered from the Great Recession, I think a lot of Americans, particularly minorities, really have benefited from Obamacare, at least if they live in states which have taken the Medicare money and basically put a significant number of people who didn't have health care on the rolls. I also think that if you go back to the 1990s, there was substantial growth in wages for African Americans because of the tight labor market, because of the earned income tax credit, which boosted wages for people who worked but were below the poverty line. So I think that the African-American loyalty to the Democratic Party partly has to do with the legacy of civil rights and, of course, Barack Obama helped. But I actually do think that there is a strong perception among a majority of African-Americans that the economic policies the Democratic Party presidents have supported have helped African-Americans. Republicans may not believe that, but I think a majority of African-Americans do believe it.
Has anybody offered a very clear plan in all of this campaign rhetoric to get people's paychecks higher?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's not a simple thing to do. I mean, the Democrats want to raise the minimum wage, for instance, right? So they believe that that would raise wages, not just for people who work the minimum wage, but that there would be a kind of cascading effect of rising wages. Now, Republicans would say, no, that's just going to lead employers to employ fewer people. And there's a empirical debate about that. I think the Democrats may have some evidence on their side. But Republicans would say, look, we're going to cut taxes on business. We're going to allow businesses to invest with fewer business and in capital gains taxes, and that's going to produce all kinds of new jobs that will benefit people. So these are two kind of very different theories about what can produce new jobs. But the reality of it is that even though we've had kind of recovery from the Great Recession under Obama, and the country's not in the kind of economic crisis it was when he took over, that, as you say, that it's still been a pretty rough period. It's been a very, very weak and slow recovery, and I don't think either side has a magic bullet to change that.
Hmm. Richard, thank you. Mike in Madison, hi.
Hi. The thing that worries me the most is that the candidates are ignoring climate change, and they need to find a positive solution to that. And I actually have one, but it's on my blog site. But it's essentially to reward people who do less annual driving, flying, and using fossil-derived fuel in their home.
All right. Yeah, I need to hold you there. Do you think that issue is being ignored? Are we fearful of that, climate change, Peter?
It's certainly being ignored in the Republican Party, where a lot of the candidates don't even accept that humans are contributing to climate change, which makes the Republican Party a remarkable outlier amongst virtually all political parties in advanced industrial democracies. In the Democratic Party, it is a fairly significant issue that people are talking about a lot. But the truth is that it's not, it's not an issue that scores right at the top of the things that voters are concerned about. And one of the problems with climate change, which I think is an issue of enormous, enormous significance, is that it's not a day-to-day issue for most people. Occasionally there may be weather events that get people's attention, but it's not like the economy, which is a kind of nagging, gnawing thing that people think about day in and day out. And again, you have a significant chunk of the conservative media that's basically denying it as an issue altogether. And so I think that makes it hard to get a debate going inside the Republican Party.
Peter Beinart with us this part of the show. We're doing a two-part hour. Atlantic editors actually have written very interesting essays in the January-February issue of The Atlantic. His particular piece, the whole magazine, the cover story is Election 2016. Peter's piece is Why America is Moving Left. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim in Wanakee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for the program. I wanted to put my two cents worth in about why I think we're moving to the left, and that is because of the way we're treating our young people. And I understand why they're looking for somebody like Bernie Sanders. It's very easy to see, like, for instance, the single-payer health care system is in the long run going to save the country incredible amounts of money. If you look at the private health care system, even under Obamacare, it's a start. But we're spending about twice as much as other countries in the world, and we still have uninsured people, and that's what's killing our young people. That and, having to pay 8% interest on college. College tuition should be free like it was, almost was, when I went to school. I'm a senior citizen. And if we want to keep our young people and make this country productive again, where we can help them build skills, we'll have a decent health care for them, and we'll also have tuition-free or affordable college and technical school kind of a thing. We're at great risk.
Peter.
I think the caller is right. There is a lot of enthusiasm behind these two proposals of Bernie Sanders, one to make college free. Hillary Clinton wants to make college debt-free, right? But it's different. As is typical with Sanders, his proposal is more ambitious. And also on health care, she wants to expand Obamacare incrementally. He wants to move towards replacing it with a single-payer system in the way they have in, Canada or Britain or many other countries. I think one of the things we're seeing is that there was a traditional idea that about American exceptionalism, which is that America didn't want to like to do things. Americans don't like to do things the way Europeans do things. Europeans are more tolerant of a larger government that's more involved in the economy, but Americans, with their rugged individualism, are very distrustful of a larger government. What you see among young people is that that is less true. The attitudes they have towards government are more like the ones we traditionally associate with Europeans. Now, part of that is simply that the demographic composition of young people is very different. A much larger percentage of young people are African American or Latino, and historically, I think non-white Americans have had a somewhat different relationship with this idea of American exceptionalism. So that's part of it. But there is a shift. Now, maybe young people will change their views as they get older, but right now, part of what I think we're seeing with Sanders' support is that his willingness to reject some of what have been kind of considered fairly core axioms of the American kind of capitalist system are gaining resonance because a lot of young people feel that way too.
Mm. Peter, I want you to, just for my own edification here, your article is titled Why America is Moving Left. We live in a state, as you know, Wisconsin, that has turned completely red over the past few years, and there are a lot of states now that are under Republican control. If America is moving left, how do you explain so many red states?
Right. That's a good question. The Republican Party has been doing very poorly at the presidential level. It hasn't won a majority. It's only won a majority in presidential elections once, going back to 1992, since George W. Bush in 2000 did not win a majority of the vote. But Republicans have had much more success at the state level. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. Partly, Republicans have done very well in midterm elections, in which the electorate tends to be older and whiter. And there's been this kind of backlash, midterm elections, against the presidential elections the Democrats have won. We saw it was a backlash election in 2010. There's been a backlash election in 2014. So I think that's part of the reason. I think there's also been organizational efforts led by the Koch brothers and others to really strengthen the Republican Party at the state level. But my argument is that for Republicans to win the presidency again, the only Republican who's going to be able to win the presidency, I think, is one who's going to have to adapt him or herself to some of the shifts that Barack Obama has produced on issues like gay rights, I think even on Obamacare, in the same way that Democrats that Bill Clinton ultimately had to accommodate himself to Ronald Reagan. Not to say that a Republican is going to be as liberal as Barack Obama, but there are certain aspects of what Barack Obama has done that are not going to be reversed.
So that means who? Marco Rubio?
Well, you know, I think that Rubio would be the Republican candidate with the best chance. You might say he's the Republican candidate with the only chance of the candidates in the top tier. But I think even Rubio, to win, I think right now would have to move substantially from where he is in the primaries in order to be able to win enough younger voters, enough Latino voters, enough single women voters in order to win. And I would say right now, given the entire tenor of the Republican race and even the effect it has had on Marco Rubio, I mean, Rubio has moved to a position where he, for instance, no longer supports any exceptions, at least according to some interpretations, for on abortion. The whole nature of this debate has made it, I think quite unlikely that a Republican is going to win in 2016. I think it's much more likely a Republican will win by 2020, but my suspicion is that the nature of the Republican debate by that point will be different.
Hmm. And one more phone call. We're getting short on time. We go to Claire in Madison. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. I'll try to be brief.
Okay.
It ties right in with what you guys were just discussing. The American public has spoken. We elected Democrats twice, and then all President Obama got was obstruction from the right. And that's not what Americans want. That's not what we voted for. So just tying into what your guest just said, if we have another Democratic president, let me put it this way. Is the makeup of the House and Senate potentially going to change enough that we can actually get some of the things that the majority of Americans want in this country?
Peter.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I think conventional wisdom, I think at the beginning of this election cycle, was that neither was likely to change very much. But I think that a lot of people think that if the Republicans nominate Ted Cruz or Donald Trump, then indeed the Senate could flip. The House would be less likely, in part because, you know, not many House members have competitive races and because of gerrymandering. But I do think that we potentially could see an election that could put the Democratic Party in a significantly stronger position because the Republican Party is, in this election, has been so focused on appealing to a group of angry, especially older white Americans, who I think are essentially opposing the cultural and demographic shifts that a majority of Americans have accommodated themselves to.
Hmm. Peter, thank you very much for being with us. Very interesting magazine and also interesting discussion. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Peter Beinart, contributing editor at The Atlantic and National Journal, associate professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York, and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Both articles from David Frum and from Peter are in the January-February issue of The Atlantic, and the cover story is Election 2016. Tomorrow during our 2 o'clock hour, we invite you to join us for another political discussion, really. We'll have many of them this year. We'll be talking to Tony Fairfax about his book, The Presidential Trend. He writes about the popular vote for the Democratic candidate for president has increased in a linear and predictable manner. We'll talk about that trend tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and for his on-air production help as well. We'll return following the news.